Good afternoon. I call this meeting of the Senate Resources Committee to order. Let the record please reflect that it is 3:36 p.m. on April 11th, 2022. Let the record also reflect that we have a quorum present today. Our Senator Stevens, Senator Kawasaki, Senator Keel, Senator Machicki, and myself, Senator Rivak, Senator Von Imhoff is excused, and Senator Bishop is conducting other business in the building today. Staffing the committee are my committee aide, Intimayo Harbison, LIO moderator, Nate Williams, and Juliana Singh from Records. Thank you, as always, for your service to this committee. I'd like to remind everybody, please turn off or silence your cell phones. For those on Teams, please keep your computer muted until it is your turn to speak so we can cut down on background noise. Thank you very much in advance for that. Today's agenda consists of two items, SB 177 microreactors, consideration of government, and then consideration of governor's appointments to the Board of Fisheries, Thomas Carpenter of Cordova, David Weiss of Wasilla, Floyd Mike Heimbusch of Homer, Heimbuck of Homer, and the Board of Game, Al Barrett of Fairbanks, and Ruth Cusack of Chugiak. And we'll jump right into SB 177 today. We're going to start. This is the second time this bill is before the committee. The first hearing, we had a number of safety questions from members, which the department has answered in a written statement distributed to this committee and posted the basis. Today we have invited the department and scientists from the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory to come review the safety and science of microreactors with the committee, which I very much appreciate. So here to present, we have Dr. Mark Nutt, Nuclear Energy Sector Manager, Pacific Northwest National Laboratory, and Gwen Holdman, Director, Alaska Center for Energy and Power. Thank you very much to both of you for your involvement. And please, put yourself on the record and walk us through your presentation.
So, good afternoon. This is Mark Nutt from the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory. And I'm picking up a crew up there, went away at Echo. So, the slides are going to run from there, I assume. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. I apologize for the date on this. We put this together when the hearing was going to be the 8th, and I just did not update it to reflect to the it being moved to today. So if we could advance to the next slide, please. Just point out, I am the what we call the sector manager for Pacific Northwest National Lab. I get the pleasure of working with our research scientists, engineers, et cetera, in all things nuclear energy at the laboratory, civilian nuclear energy, be it from the front end to the back end of the reactor safety. My technical area is really in the spent fuel management area, and I'll talk a little bit about that earlier. I am a nuclear engineer. Early in my career, I was actually working at one of the operating plants in the United States, the plants operated by Fluor Power and Light, St. Lucie and Turkey Point. So I've got kind of boots on the ground experience at some of these stations. My colleague, Bruce McDowell, one of our senior advisors, who's really an environmental expert, unfortunately couldn't make the hearing today. So I get to carry the load myself. Just a map showing where we're at, state of Washington, southeast corner, broad spectrum of work. Probably half of that portfolio is in touches in nuclear in one shape, way, shape, or form, energy, national security, environmental restoration. So we are very well versed in the nuclear area. Next slide, please. Just to point out kind of a bottom line up front is nuclear power is safe. The hazards have been known and have always been factored into design, safety analysis, regulation of these machines. It is one of the most heavily regulated commercial enterprises out there. Our Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which is kind of held up as the example across the world, you know, has the principal responsibility of oversight. And, you know, their mission, and they take it seriously, is protection of public health and safety. by ensuring that the plants comply with their licenses and the administrative requirements, and also by reviewing and looking at those applications that come before them to grant the applications for the reactors to be deployed, of which they then review. Today, they assign 2 resident inspectors at each of the stations across the country, where they do tremendous amount of inspections each year. There's also the Institute of Nuclear Power Operations that is somewhat of a regulatory body. It's not the regulator, but it's a kind of self-imposed group that the industry has put over itself that really looks for operational excellence at the power plants. They do peer reviews on sites, inspections, a lot of different studies. They have a lot of different metrics really aiming to ensure the operational excellence of the plants. And just across, there's major studies across that have been done that really show it's an exceptionally safe way, to produce electricity, produce energy on an industrial scale. Next slide, please.
If we could take a pause there. We do have a couple questions, one from Senator Stevens first.
Oh, thank you, Dr. Nutt. I appreciate your comments, and we keep hearing that about the safety. I appreciate your trying to satisfy us that it's safe. But maybe you could address what's different right now in the Ukraine, where the nuclear power plants became targets, and we are in a different generation of equipment, I assume. Why were they a target in Ukraine, and why would they not be a target here in the United States?
I probably shouldn't speculate a whole lot what's going on in Ukraine. It's not my area of expertise, the military side. I do know the reactor in Zaporizhia. It's a Russian, what they call a VVER, very similar in design to the pressurized water reactors we have today. I don't know a whole lot about what's gone on over there, and I'd be speculating on what the damage has been done. The Chernobyl exclusion zone's a different area. It's where they had the disaster several years ago. The plants are all shut down, and they have a lot of they have the sarcophagus over the damaged plant, and they have a lot of fuel in storage up there, along with the contamination that's on the ground. Yeah. Personally, I hope in the U.S., I don't look to us to ever be in a situation where we're having people shooting at our reactors on our own territory. It's a very bad situation. I hope that answered or gave you enough answer.
Well, Mr. Chairman, so I appreciate those comments. I guess what I've sort of heard is that we are in a different situation now. We are in a different generation of nuclear power plants. And so what we keep hearing from the experts is that the new plants that you're talking about here today are remarkably safer than the old ones that we were used to with the tall water towers. Is that true?
That's correct. And I can talk to you a little bit about that further in the presentation.
Oh, good. Thank you.
Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you. Mr. Nutt, for being here today. Just a couple questions on bullet 2 and bullet 3. It mentions 2 NRC resident inspectors at every facility, 2,000 hours of baseline inspections every year. And it also mentions the Institute of Nuclear Power teams doing on-site 2-week inspections once every 2 years. Is that going to be the same for these micro nuclear reactors or advanced nuclear reactors?
I think that would have to be determined when they go through their licensing, and then they work with the Institute of Nuclear Power Operations. They are different models. These new advanced machines, some of these micro reactors, they are expecting to have a lot of passive and inherent safety features, which I'll talk to in a few minutes. They may have reduced staffing size. They may have reduced requirements, but all that will be ultimately need to be vetted through the licensing process with the regulator.
And then follow up. And I guess this could be discussed in terms of the following slide related to the, I'm not sure how many are on here, the small nuclear reactors that are currently under development. If you could, when we get to the second slide, just explain how much time compared to this slide those are required to have, just in terms of to get that question vetted. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Machicki.
Yeah, I find your last line kind of interesting, being a guy who was in the LNG industry for 38 years. I don't know what you're talking about. Other than a single incident in 1944, prior to folks understanding that LNG had to be stored in a 9% nickel stainless tank, if you will, the Cleveland incident that killed 138, there's been like 7 or 8 fatalities since. So did we just go throughout the entire history of each industry? It's just a strange comparison.
Okay, I just know there's really been in the U.S., you know, no direct fatalities on operated nuclear that I'm aware of.
Okay, so it's just a general history-wide comparison. I guess your point is, and I agree with your point, that it's been an extremely safe, even natural gas has occasional incidents that result in fatalities. It's just strange that you picked one of those one of those components. I've been around the globe making a similar presentation like you are today. So you might just pick a different one, but that's okay. Yeah. I get it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, please continue.
Okay, moving on to slide 4. So there's questions about the different sizes of the reactors. And there has been an evolution over the years. You know, they originally started small, and then they moved to be very large units. And the units deployed today aren't even showing on this scale. Some of them are, you know, upwards and exceeding the 1,000-megawatt electric line. You know, they were large power plants, a lot of construction done on site. And, you know, we've proven we don't have the greatest track record in deploying these. You know, the Vogtle plant in South Carolina, Georgia, is starting to become over budget, taking a lot of time to get deployed. There's evidence around the world. So the industry moved and said, we need to do things, you know, a little more streamlined, which led to kind of the ideas that were in the, you know, 100 megawatt to 1,000 megawatt range. Smaller plants, a lot of factory built that would be then assembled at the power station. And you can see there's a number of reactors out there of different sizes, some down around 70, 60, 70 megawatts, where they will, you know, deploy a handful of them at a reactor site. You know, they envision being there, you know, 60, 70, 80 years. Some civil construction required to actually house the plant. You know, if you look at NuScale's design, it's, you know, 4, 6, and 12 pack modules. There'll be some civil construction around that to house the modules. You know, the XE10 reactor, an XE100 reactor that X Energy's looking, you know, same thing, a smaller version of a fixed unit, really aiming to deliver, you know, electricity to the grid. Last few years, or last several years, there's been an evolution towards even smaller reactor designs that are, you know, can service a lot of different markets and a lot of different opportunities. And that led, you know, you see these micro reactors typically, you know, under about 50 megawatts or lower, about a notional cutoff for them. And, you know, they represent a whole different application of nuclear energy compared to what these larger stations are for, you know, off-grid, industrial, you know, supporting military bases, really focused uses where, you know, upwards of tens of megawatts may be needed, you know, versus 60, 70 to hundreds. You know, the idea is, you know, rather than doing more of a, you know, they did aim to reduce civil construction that would be required to house the reactor at the plant when they went to the smaller modular type reactors. And they drove that, they're driving that down even more so with the micro reactors. So essentially the idea is what'll get deployed. The entire reactor will be brought out, loaded up, or installed and operated. And then with some having business models that they will take the whole thing away when it is expired and possibly bring in another one. So just the size of them presents different ways they can be utilized and different ways they would be deployed. No questions. Next slide, please.
Yeah, I think we'll we want to make sure we get through all this and we still have confirmation. So if we could hold questions unless we have something really relevant and timely. Yeah, please continue.
So the other terms, you know, what's an advanced reactor? And, you know, typically you may have heard, you know, sometimes they're called generation 4 reactors. You know, the generation 3s kind of led to the light water reactors that are being deployed today or have been deployed up through today. You know, and they call some of them generation 3 plus. You know, that'd be the Vogtle station. It's really an evolution of the third generation reactors. The generation 4, the advanced reactors, you know, all have a lot of the improvements that you're seeing from here, which is in, you know, the 42 U.S. code that I've got linked on the screen here. But if you really flip to the next slide, it's some of these highlighted issues that really, you know, kind of did come into play with a lot of these, you know, inherent safety features. I'll talk to some of those in a moment. Tolerance for loss of fuel cooling, reduced reliance on water and other environmental impacts. But really to take the existing experience from the safe operation of the machines that have ran up through, you know, roughly today to deploy, you know, newer, better, more safe, more efficient, more economic machines in the future. Next slide, please. And I'll talk a little bit about this passively and inherent safe designs. And this really isn't for just micro reactors. It's for all the new advanced reactors that are being looked at today. Is, you know, basically relying on physics and Mother Nature to really provide what we call passive safety, where the reactor doesn't require operator actions or even electronic feedback in order to shut down safely and then continue to cool itself after it's shut down. And the other one's inherent safety, where you design and build with materials that have properties that provide additional layers of protection. You know, I've got a video on the link here that Idaho National Laboratory does a really good passive safety video. We won't go through it here, but you're happy to, or you can link to it whenever you want. I'll jump into a little bit more detail on kind of each one of these, the inherent and passive sides, on the next ones if we're ready to move. So you've probably heard a lot, I'm sure you have, about, you know, TRISO fuel, tri-structural isotropic particle fuel. It's a fuel that's been in development within the Department of Energy's lab complex for a long time. A lot of research being done on it, where it is a very, very robust fuel. They're small. They can put them into different fuel forms. Pebbles are what you're seeing on the bottom. They can put them into what they call compacts and use them very differently in the different reactor concepts. Micro reactors, even up to the larger, you know, 100 megawatt small modular reactors. They are very resistant to radiation, corrosion, oxidation, and high temperatures. So these can withstand much higher temperatures than the existing reactor fuel can today. And they themselves act as their own little containment structure. If you look at the top figure on the left, the fuel's kind of in the middle, those little dot areas, with multiple barriers put between the fuel and then the outside of the fuel kernel itself. So there's a number of designed multiple barriers between the fuel and the outside of the fuel, and then between the the fuel and the public or the workers that'd be working the plant. There's other fuel designs that are being looked at for some of these advanced reactors, including micro reactors that have a lot of the same inherent safety features. Next slide, please. And then you have the active versus passive. So today's plants today are all what we call, actively protected. If you have an event at a reactor, the first thing that happens is the control rods drop in the core and the nuclear chain reaction goes away. But you still have decay heat coming off the radioactive decay of the fuel that you still have to maintain cooling. And in today's plants, that requires active pumping. There's safety injection systems, there's diesel generators to provide power if you lose offsite power. But the plant has to be actively cooled. There has to be motors running. There has to be fluid flowing around the plant to keep the fuel cool. Next slide, please. If you transition that through some of today's designs, they can take advantage of passive heat removal. A lot of them use natural air circulation. So essentially this little cartoon graphic on the left, the heat's in the reactor core, the reactor shut down. You're still getting decay heat coming off the reactor, and that heat has to be removed. There's sufficient heat transfer to move the heat out of the reactor, and then just natural air circulation flowing by it. That in itself can keep the plant cool enough, can protect the fuel to where, essentially they can be walk-away safe. And that combined with the inherent safety that the fuel offers, really provides much more safety margin than the reactors have been deployed today. Next slide, please. Just a slide here to just show you kind of what does the NRC look like when they do a safety review of any commercial reactor. I'm not going to go through all these, but they are, the applicant has to come in and show how they're going to meet, all these the criteria within the guidance, within the regulatory framework, and the NRC will go look at all these categories to ensure that that application adequately covers the safety needed out of it. And this will hold true for any reactor that will be deployed, now for the next, into the future. Next slide, please. We talked a little bit earlier about the staffing and, what skills would be required. And, I don't know, have the answer to that. From what I've seen, it does look like, all the advanced reactors are looking to reduce staffing size. That is one of the drivers for operational cost of the reactors today. So they're looking at reducing the number of staff required. Some of the micro reactors are looking at some forms of automation to remove humans from controlling the reactor and let automation do it. But what I'll point out is that, again, this will be something that'll go through with the regulator, who will make the licensing decision of what are the individuals that need to be there to operate the reactor, to supervise the operation, to maintain it, to maintain security, and in general, it'll be through that licensing where you'll know the skilled technicians that have to be at the actual reactor site itself. Next, please. So another area is how's the spent fuel from these machines going to be managed? And to just point out, there are multiple agencies and organizations that have responsibility for managing spent fuel. The Nuclear Waste Policy Act of 1982 is amended, really establishing the comprehensive federal policy to store and dispose of our country's spent fuel and high-level waste. It really gave that responsibility to DOE and directs the department to develop a system to accept, transport, store, and dispose. The NRC regulates interim storage. It regulates permanent disposal, and it also certifies the casks that would be used to transport materials around. You know, the EPA sets the radiation protection standards. The utility or operator is responsible for, you know, like siting, designing, submitting the license application, and an environmental report to the regulators I mentioned before. You know, the NRC will prepare an environmental impact statement for that reactor and will conduct a review of the application. And then the utility operator constructs and operates in accordance with its license. Next slide, please. There is an established regulatory framework for the storage of spent fuel at 10 CFR Part 72 and the transportation of spent fuel at 10 CFR Part 71. You know, that regulatory framework is well established. You know, yes, we do not have a national repository yet for spent fuel. So there's two options that are being managed, that are being pursued right now for the current fleet. It's being stored at what are called independent spent fuel storage installations at the reactor sites under 10 CFR 72. And, you know, the same could be done for microreactors, or there's been options of returning it back to the vendor for decommissioning or refueling. This would require some new packaging to be approved, as there's currently no approved packages for moving microreactors, fueled microreactors that have the fuel inside them. On the storage side or the waste management side, the Department of Energy has launched its effort to site a federal consolidator and storage facility using a consent-based siting process, and is going to be actively out looking for potential volunteers to host such a facility. Next slide, please. And, you know, a wide range of environmental impacts are looked at by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission during the NEPA review of putting a plan in place. Some of them will be different for microreactors just due to their size compared to the existing fleet, due to their potential lower amount of water use, lower amount of air emissions, you know, longer duty cycles, so less transportation. So, you know, the expected environmental impacts are expected to be smaller for that. You know, I will point out that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is in the process of developing a generic environmental impact statement for advanced reactors that will include the microreactors in it. I believe a draft is looking to be coming out probably this summer. And the final slide, you know, what are some of the unique challenges in the Arctic? You know, you've got permafrost, you've got different environments than are what is down in the continental U.S. And, you know, I'll just point out that, you know, geotechnical evaluations for the foundations to support these machines would have to be done, and it'd have to be demonstrated that, you know, they adequately will support it to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. You'll have to do hazards assessment to look at what hazards, external hazards, the reactor could be exposed to, and look at, you know, make sure that all those are properly mitigated. And there's also a variety of codes that the NRC uses to evaluate, you know, radiation exposure potentials from nuclear power plants during siting evaluations. And they're being looked at right now for use in Arctic environments. And with that, I will close.
All right, questions. We had one from Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you again, Mr. Nutt, for being on tonight. My question again regarding staffing had to deal with, I'll just reiterate kind of what you said, was that part of the reason why we're looking at these micronuclear reactors was to look to reduce staffing, and I guess I've got a little bit of concern with that. And can you tell me whether this particular one that we're talking about, and it hasn't been cited and it hasn't been approved, but it's 5 megawatt roughly at Eielson Air Force Base in Fairbanks. Would before the siting is done, before the proposed project is there, would you have to know sort of the staffing levels, how many inspections would be done per year. They won't, of course, be nearly the 2,000 hours per year or have two people involved. Would those considerations have to be made by the NRC before a permit or license is provided?
That's correct. Okay. Yes, they would. That would be part of the licensing process, and the applicant would have to come in and, you know, here's our staffing, here's how we're going to operate this plant, and, you know, here's why we believe that the staffing level is, you know, adequate for public safety and security. Then the NRC would go through the review, and, you know, at the end of the day, you know, they would come up with here's the staffing requirements. And in order to keep that reactor running, they would have to have that staffing there. You know, if the NRC inspectors came in and they were missing staff, they could shut it down.
And then through the chair, then also for siting purposes, would the site need to be reviewed by NRC staff and approved before siting is approved and permitted?
Correct. Correct. There are a couple ways, and I don't need to go into detail, but yes, the site in itself, the natural hazards, the geotechnical stability, all of that goes into the review of the safety analysis that has to be done.
Okay. I have another one, but I'll wait
for. Okay, Senator Machicki.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Nutt. I so just kind of being used to things like exclusion zones based on the quantity of energy in a facility. Is it safe to say just across the board that two facilities designed similarly, 1 gigawatt versus 50 megawatt, have a significantly lower potential for the lower quantity of fuel at a facility?
I'd say off the top of my head, yes, but again, it depends. It would depend on the fuel, the release mechanisms, the source term that would come out. You know, if I had a 50 megawatt facility that had just extremely robust fuel, and, you know, a 10 megawatt facility that's fuel was perhaps not as robust, they could wash out, but it really goes back to the analysis of what are the accidents, what are the accident sequences, what could happen, what are the source terms, the amount of material that could be released, and where does it go? And typically a larger machine with a larger inventory could have a larger source term.
Okay, just a brief follow-up. We've heard that there may not be any exclusion zones needed for the smaller microreactors that are self-contained. Does that like also mean that the seismology and the, you know, flooding tsunami potential is less important with these if they're truly self-contained, or is that an assumption not correct?
Well, I think it goes back to where it would be sited. Yeah, you would site one of these reactors to avoid flood zones, tsunami zones. You would site it such that the geotechnical hazards, seismicity, would not cause the unit undue harm. You know, it could respond to, you know, an earthquake. It could respond to whatever it needs and do safe shutdown. And then with the passive heat removal, it could maintain safe. The containment in a lot of these, I pointed out that the TRISO fuel, a lot of, you know, the hazardous fission products are retained in the fuel itself. So, you know, if through the safety analysis about analyzing the event sequences, analyzing the hazards, looking at the consequences, you know, it could be possible to show that there's really no credible way this machine could get damaged. And in that case, they may be able to back off the exclusion zone.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thanks so much, Dr. Nutt, for being here and helping out. I guess a question about the implications of disposal when we're all done. I think you mentioned that there is no packaging approved for transporting these small reactors when they're finished. Do we envision then that they'll be left to cool hypothetically forever on site, or do we imagine that they're going to end up in that big trench on the Hanford Reach with a couple of hundred former nuclear submarine reactors? Where do they go?
Well, for clarity, what's on the Hanford Reach is the reactor compartments and the reactors. The fuel's gone. They take the fuel out and they ship that to Idaho where it's stored. And then the reactors and the cores themselves are brought up to Hanford and stored in an open trench so people from up above can take a look at them and make sure they're there. Right now all the fuel that's been generated, the existing fleets, is stored at the reactors pending, the department either deploying a consolidated urban storage facility or a geologic repository, and then it would be transported there. We do have certified cask to move the existing light water reactor fuel. It's proven technology. It's been out there. If there was a business model where, the reactor was going to be ran, micro reactor was sited and ran for a while, yes, if there was not a disposition pathway, a storage or disposal facility, it would have to sit till one becomes available. If a company has a business model where they're going to transport it away, they would need to get the package certified through the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, to be able to go pick it up, package it, and move it away. Likewise, they have to come up with one to move, a fully fueled micro reactor itself. Right now we move, we move spent fuel, or we move both radiated and unrated fuel in transportation packagings, but we've never moved a reactor. What I will offer is that, the department does understand that. They understand they've got the responsibility they need to meet. They're moving to restart the process, or they have restarted the process to site an interim storage facility. And there's other projects underway within, on the Department of Defense side to look at transporting micro reactors. So there is being work done to develop those capabilities to move those machines around.
Mr. Chairman, another.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess maybe just a broader strokes kind of question. And I think TRISO, the idea came up in the late 1960s. I heard about it in high school back in the 90s. I guess the broader question is, what's taking so long? We kept hearing this is just a few years away, and so we're considering legislation now. Are we ready for this legislation? What is the pace of change here, or is this a little like there's a much beloved idea for a different energy source here in Alaska that's about 5 years away, and it always has been?
So with the TRISO, yes, it's been around a while. People have looked at TRISO. I could argue that essentially all these advanced reactors have been around for a while. Molten salt reactors that are out there, they're a little more advanced than I think what people are thinking about for micros. Metallic fueled fast reactors, TRISO fueled reactors. A lot of those have been looked at. We've operated gas reactors, gas cooled carbide fueled reactors in the U.S. and worldwide. So there's experience. But, the world in the U.S. in general, chose the water reactor route. I think a lot of that was driven by, the Navy picked water reactors and away we went. In the meantime, through the Department of Energy and the national labs continued developing these advanced reactor concepts, because there are, you know, there are benefits. There are the inherent passive safety benefits that are out there. You know, there's other benefits. You know, gas reactors can operate at higher temperatures. They're more efficient machines. They can be used for process heat. So the technology kept getting developed, and the technology to deploy these machines kept improving, to where we got to a point where, you know, with the decisions to go with, you know, continued deployment of new nuclear in the U.S., you know, the private sector companies have said, you know, a lot of them have said, we want to go some of these different routes. You know, especially if you're going to go with a micro reactor, you're going to want to look at some different coolant technologies and different fuels that have been out there today. So long story short, I think the technology advancements has really enabled these machines to be, you know, deployed, you know, economically as they need to be to compete in the U.S. energy markets.
Everybody good? All right. Great. Well, thank you so much for your presentation, Mark. Did you have more to add?
Mr. Chairman, I'm Laura Ashe. I'm the liaison for the department. Gwen Holdman, as well as Christina Carpenter, our division director, are online and would be happy to answer any further questions or speak to anything that you have a desire for them to speak on.
Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't know who can answer this. Because these advanced nuclear reactor, the potential of an advanced nuclear reactor at Eielson Air Force Base is being discussed under the Department of Defense. We're talking about whether NRC would have authority and jurisdiction over that, and in order for siting, permitting, and all the requirements that Dr. Nutt had discussed earlier today.
If you're speaking, yeah, go ahead. We couldn't hear you. You might have been on mute.
I'd offer that depends on how it would be deployed. If it would be a commercial company providing power services to Eielson, I believe it would have to be NRC licensed. And Gwen, you look like you're ready to answer.
Yeah, go ahead, Gwen, if you could put yourself on the record. And just a reminder, every time you speak, if you wouldn't mind putting yourself on the record for our good folks that staff the committee here, we'd appreciate it. You're on mute. We're going to take just a brief at ease real quick and get Ms. Holdman connected. All right, we're back on the record. Ms. Holdman, it looks like you have a mute over your microphone there. Are you unmuted or muted? There.
Are you able to hear me now?
There we go. Yes, ma'am.
Excellent. Thank you. My name is Gwen Holdman. I'm the director of the Alaska Center for Energy and Power in Fairbanks at University of Alaska Fairbanks. I am currently calling in from Las Vegas, Nevada today. I would be happy to answer that particular question. The project at Eielson is expected to actually be a commercial project. It would be privately owned and operated on Air Force property, and would be the power from that, the output from that reactor would be sold through a power purchase agreement by an independent power producer, and as such, it would fully fall under NRC jurisdiction for that particular project.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Gwen, for being online, Ms. Holdman, for being online. So I guess my question is, we just had testimony from DOE saying that NRC, the National Nuclear Regulatory Commission, would require a bunch of things, including staffing considerations before permitting or siting, They would have to understand spent fuel management. They would have to understand how many inspections would be done per year, and the hours that are necessary. So even though we anticipate, that there might be something at Eielson, we don't actually know that it will be Eielson at this point. Is that what you're saying?
No, the project is intended at this point in time, unless they're through their environmental processes that they're going through. The plan is to have the project at Eielson and Air.
If you could, you're breaking up pretty bad. Maybe you could shut off your video and just use audio. If you could try that. We weren't able to hear most of what you're saying. It's breaking up in and out. Could you try shutting off your video, please?
Okay. Yes, I've done that. My apologies. How is that? Is that better?
It's a little bit shaky. Maybe give it a try.
All right. A project at Eielson Space, this Alaska Center for Energy and Power, any project at Eielson Air Force Base would have to comply with any additional state requirements that are above and beyond what would be required by the NRC.
So let me clarify the question again through the chair, is that this whole presentation was about an NRC-regulated facility. My question is, if Eielson is found to be not the right place because of either staffing considerations or natural features or spent fuel management issues, and the NRC says that's not the place, I guess I'm trying to figure out what process we're in right now and whether Eielson may not be the place because of these considerations that the NRC makes later.
Yes, through the chair, this is Gwen Holman from the Alaska Center for Energy and Power. That is quite possible, Senator, that there are some insurmountable barriers that come up another Air Force base at another location.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have other questions?
I have a question.
Yes, Senator Machicki.
Mr. Nutt, this bill is pointed at advanced nuclear reactors with the definition 42 USC 16271. Can you explain that to us? So I when this first came about, folks were thinking of Three Mile Island and other facilities as opposed to what we're talking about in this bill. And I don't mean confused. It's just we, as Americans, we remember those Chernobyl-like stories. And just curious, what is so different about the definition of the advanced nuclear reactor in the USC 42.
Mark Nutt, Pacific Northwest National Lab. I think it's the cutoff dated December 27, 2020. You're comparing back to those reactors that have been built and deployed of today, and it's essentially our large light water reactor fleet, boiling water reactors, pressurized water reactors. You know, like the one at Three Mile Island that had its accident years ago. And it's pointing to these new advanced machines have to show improvements over the existing fleets and the 11 bullets that were on the slide that I presented. So, it's not just an incremental step up in the reactors today. It's really these things are different than what's out there today. And again, we would call them in our area, a generation four machine. It'd be the fourth generation of essentially reactors that are out there. They're, very advanced, taking a lot of improvements across the board.
Okay, just a quick.
That help?
Yeah, it does. And just quick follow up. And this is just actually comes from a constituent that an Alaska constituent that was worried about the enrichment of microreactor fuel. Are they significantly? Is the fuel significantly more enriched? And what does that factor look like as far as it translates into risk?
Yeah, Mark Pianell again. They are looking at using higher enriched fuels up to right now the existing reactors run at about a limit of 5% uranium-235 enrichment. Your 235 is the fissile element. These machines are looking at running up to around 20%. And you do that to get, you know, increased fissile material loading in the reactor core, which allows you to go smaller, allows you to run longer. Again, I go back to that they're going to, even with the higher enriched uranium in these machines, there's still going to be all these passive and inherent safety features involved. You know, they wouldn't be operated, you know, still within safety envelopes. They'd still have to meet, you know, demonstrate that these machines would be operated safely and securely. So, yeah, it is higher. I don't think it's significantly enough higher to really, you know, make too much of a difference. And it's necessary to really make these machines work the way the people want them to work.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Other questions? Okay, thank you again very much for your presentation. I think what we're going to do is we're going to set this bill aside, and we're going to start on some of the confirmations. So, again, I appreciate you being here. Thank you very much for walking us through that presentation. Okay. We're going to move on right into governor's appointees. First, we're going to start with Mr. Carpenter for the Board of Fisheries. Mr. Carpenter, when you are ready, if you could please put yourself on the record and give us a brief description about your background and tell us why you're interested in serving.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, sir.
All right, thank you. Members of the Senate Resource Committee, thank you for this opportunity. My name is Tom Carpenter. I'm 53 years old and have lived in Cordova for 30 years. My wife, Gretchen, was born and raised in Cordova. She teaches elementary school. We were married in 2001 and have a 13-year-old daughter. We enjoy taking full advantage of the landscape, subsistence fishing on the Copper River for salmon each May, sport fishing for salmon and cutthroat on the Delta throughout the summer and fall, hunting moose and seeking deer on the islands of Prince William Sound. Growing up in southern Illinois, this was far from the landscapes of Alaska. I dreamed one day of making the journey north. After college, I enlisted in the United States Coast Guard, spending 1 year in Puerto Rico, and finally reaching Alaska, where I was stationed in Cordova. I was immediately blown away by the mountainous terrain, the diversity of hunting and fishing, and the opportunities those natural resources afforded people. Immediately after completing my commitment with the United States Coast Guard, I jumped onto a seine boat as a crewman, fishing for salmon and herring in Prince William Sound. The next summer, I was given the opportunity to crew on a gillnetter on the Copper River, which I did for a few summers. I worked the winters in Cordova, saving money, and bought my first boat and permit in 1999. During my formative years in Alaska, I started attending advisory committee meetings, trying to educate myself on how Alaska fisheries management worked. I dove in headfirst, and next year was named co-chair of the Copper River Prince William Sound Advisory Committee, where I remained co-chair until 2019. In 2020, I was awarded the Alaska Department of Fish and Game Excellence in Service Award. I commercial fished in Area E from 1995 to 2014, gillnetting on the Copper River in Prince William Sound. while simultaneously operating a sporting goods retail business with a focus on sport fishing and hunting gear. From 2015 to 2019, I was the regional fleet manager for Copper River Seafoods. I also served on the Copper River Prince William Sound Salmon Harvest Task Force, becoming chairman in 2019. From 2003 to 2018, I served on the South Central Regional Advisory Committee, dealing primarily with subsistence issues. I was elected to serve on the Cordova Telephone Cooperative Board from 2002 to 2009, served on the Prince William Sound Aquaculture Board from 2002 to 2005, then starting again in 2018, where I am currently chairman of the board. I also serve on the Prince William Sound Regional Planning Team and am currently the chairman. I retired in 2019, and during the last 2 years, I reflected on how Alaska's natural resources have provided me so many great opportunities. I want to continue to give back to Alaska, which has given me so much, and through this unique process from which our fish and game resources are managed, I decided to submit my name for consideration to serve on the Alaska Board of Fisheries. Alaska has a world-class management system full of experienced managers and scientists while incorporating the highest level of public input. If I'm afforded the opportunity to serve, I will pursue diplomacy with the different user groups, finding common ground while analyzing the most current science-based information to make the most informed decisions possible. Alaska leads the world in sustainable fisheries management, and with continued support from the legislature and having a diverse board, this can continue for many generations to come. Thank you for this opportunity, and I would welcome any questions.
All right, thank you, Mr. Carpenter. Questions from the committee? Senator Stevens.
Just a comment. Thank you, Tom, for applying for this board. You've had enormous experience and opportunities to know what's going on. And I guess in the end, there's no excuse for you not knowing what you're getting into, right?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, I'm well aware of what I'm getting myself into. I think the last 30 years have proven that sometimes decisions that are made at board levels, as well as decisions that you all make on a daily basis. Sometimes there's people that are not happy with it, but I think you have to interpret the data that you have, the best data you have in front of you, and make those decisions and try and stand by them.
I appreciate that. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you, Senator Stevens. Senator Marchicki.
Yeah, thank you, and thanks for being willing to put your name out there, Mr. Carpenter. So you talked about the world-class fisheries, yet we have a number of fisheries around the state that are failing from what someone can challenge at times as management that has been unsuccessful. And I'm sure you recognize that. I guess my question is going to be how lead-lined are you about moving into a process that is so heavily influenced by outside forces who essentially live at the Board of Fish process or heavily influential? It's a tough place to make an independent decision. How are you going to be different?
Through the chair, Senator Marchicki, I understand what you're saying completely. There are definitely different organizations and user groups around the state that tend to come to these meetings and be, very effective in having conversations and trying to get their point across, maybe a little bit more than the average person might think that they're going to be able to do it. And I think the years that I spent on the advisory committee, I think that's a very important place for not only the general public to go to local regional meetings to try and come up with the best sort of solutions and bring those to the board for their consideration. But I think that, you know, Alaska is the only state that allows this sort of participation with the public. You know, the Board of Fish has the unique position of not only allowing for public comment, but when the committee of the whole meets to deal with very specific proposals broke down into categories, it gives them once again the opportunity to get their point across. And I think that I will look at the public and the organizations through the same lens. And I think that factual information and scientific information is what I'm going to use to make my best informed decision.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you. And thanks for extending your interest in this, Mr. Carpenter. There's just a technical question I have. You serve on the Aquaculture Corporation Board, and you're the chairman. Thank you. You also serve on a couple advisory committees. And I'm wondering, if you were to become a member of the Board of Fish, do you have to resign from those positions?
Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, thank you for that question. I'm glad you asked that. And I can give you a very direct answer to that. The one thing that's very important to me is transparency. And I think it's important through this process, and I'm not so sure that it's always been the case. My direct answer to you is I've already informed the board of directors that if I am confirmed by the legislature, that I will resign effective immediately so that there is no conflict of interest moving forward. In regards to the other boards and commissions that I serve on, I currently serve as the chairman of the regional planning team for Prince William Sound and the Copper River. We are having a meeting in about 7 days, and likewise, I will make the same announcement to that group at that time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that. I wasn't actually aware if you needed to or not, and I appreciated your candid answer, sir. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Carpenter. Thank you very much for your willingness to serve and being here to testify in front of the committee today. We are going to move on to public testimony. For Mr. Carpenter, public testimony is now open. And before we start, I would just like to ask folks, please keep your comments as brief as possible, certainly no more than 2 minutes. We're probably going to push a little bit late in this hearing, and we still have, I believe, four other folks. So if you'd be so kind to keep your comments concise, we'd all very much appreciate it. So your name and affiliation. And for or against in brief comments. We're going to start with Shauna Williams online. Shauna from Wasilla.
Hello. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members, for this opportunity to testify before you. My name is Shauna Williams, and I'm a resident of Wasilla, Alaska. I'm here today in support of the appointment of Tom Carpenter to the Board of Fisheries. I've had the pleasure of serving with Mr. Carpenter on the Prince William Sound Aquaculture Board. During this time of service, I witnessed his hard work and dedication to fisheries. As chairman of PSWAC, Mr. Carpenter has always carefully balanced the best interests of not only the corporation, but also the best interests of each and every user group that the corporation serves. The level of knowledge and experience Mr. Carpenter has obtained with his former military service, who has participated in fisheries as a commercial sports assistance fisheries user, is immense. In addition, his work for Copper River Seafoods and his service to PSWAC board. With all this experience, I feel making a very well-rounded candidate to make fair and equitable decisions regarding fisheries for all user groups around the state of Alaska. Thank you very much for this opportunity to speak, and I welcome any questions.
Thank you, Shauna. Really appreciate it. Next, we're going to move on to Charles Derrick. Charles, please name, affiliation, and brief comments.
Yes, thank you. My name's Chuck Derrick. I am the president of the Chittenden Dipnetters Association, the nonprofit voice for the thousands of Alaska residents who participate in the Copper River personal use dipnet fishery. The Chittenden Dipnetters Association is in opposition to the confirmation of Tom Carpenter to the Board of Fisheries. The mentality of the Prince William Sound Aquaculture Corporation is that more hatchery fish is better, and the ever-increasing release of Prince William Sound hatchery pink salmon has resulted in the strain of those pinks into many of the South Central salmon streams, with the potential to dilute the genetics of our wild stocks in those streams. Additionally, many of us feel that the ever-increasing millions of hatchery pinks being released into the ocean are competing for food with Alaska's wild stocks, resulting in much smaller wild stock returns and much smaller fish. Being the chairman of the Prince William Sound Aquaculture Corporation, I feel Mr. Carpenter will promote the continued increase in the release of hatchery fish, and our wild stocks will suffer. Thank you.
All right, thank you very much, Chuck. Next, we will move on to Virgil from Fairbanks. Virgil.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman.
Hello, sir.
My name is Virgil Umpenauer. I live in North Pole. I served three terms on the Board of Fisheries. I just finished on Thursday, a six-day meeting. I'm a member of the Yukon River panel, which is one of the panels for the Pacific Salmon Treaty. I've been on that since 1988. One of the biggest problems we have right now is sustainability of our fisheries. In the Yukon River, for summer chum salmon, we normally have an average run of 2 million fish. We had 152,000 this year. Fall chum salmon, we normally have 1 million fish. This year, this past year, we had 102,000. The Chena River and the Souša River near Fairbanks are the two largest producers of king salmon in the Yukon River drainage. That includes Canada and the United States. They got 22% of their escapement with zero fishing of any kind, including subsistence. Subsistence was totally closed for the Yukon River pre-season in 2021. One of the biggest problems is overgrazing in the marine pasture. Pizwak is one of the biggest, they are the largest producer of hatchery salmon in the state of Alaska. They produce in the neighborhood of 700 to 800 million pink salmon and over 200 million chum salmon a year put into Prince William Sound. The North Pacific Agronomous Fisheries Commission, which is made up of scientists and it's an international treaty between the United States, Canada, South Korea, Japan, and Russia, have finally come out and said 5.5 billion hatchery salmon into the North Pacific a year is causing the fish to starve to death in the ocean. The fish that were measured and weighed on the Yukon River this year by the department scientists were the smallest weights, smallest size of salmon per age ever measured. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you, Virgil. I don't believe I see anybody else online to testify for Mr. Carpenter. Okay, Karen Gillis, are you online to testify for Mr. Carpenter? If you are, please name and affiliation and brief testimony.
Karen Gillis, I'm the executive director at Bering Sea Fishermen's Association. And in order to keep this short, I definitely want to echo Chuck's comments and Virgil's. I very much agree with them in their opposition to Mr. Carpenter. As seasoned as he is, I believe his expertise doesn't capture any diversity on the board. I do have a sense that this governor does not understand the makeup of the Board of Fisheries as it has been historically, because we wouldn't be seeing the kinds of appointments that we're seeing currently. And I, again, oppose Mr. Carpenter.
Okay, thank you, Karen. Is there one more for? Okay, yes, Paul. Paul, please put yourself on the record and give us 2 minutes or less.
Yes, yeah, Senator Reback, this is Paul Shadura. I live here in the Kasilof, Alaska. Today, I would like to remind the board of the Alaska Statute 1605-221, modified in 1975, about 47 years ago. The qualifications, in brief: interest in public affairs, good judgment, knowledge, and ability in the field of action of the board, and with a view to providing diversity of interest. Further, it says within the statute that the members shall be appointed without regard to a political affiliation or geographical location of residence. Mr. Carpenter would add to the board process his experience in regulatory matters, commercial fish experience, education, and small business operations can only enhance the deliberations within the Board of Fish regulatory process. And with that, I would recommend that you support this individual for confirmation. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Paul. All right, I don't see any others online. Somebody verify that for me. Okay, that is correct. Do we have anybody in the room who would like to testify on Mr. Carpenter? Yes, ma'am. Please come forward. Name, affiliation, 2 minutes or less.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Thank you for scheduling today's hearing, and thank you for the opportunity to testify. For the record, my name is Tracy Welch, and I'm here today representing United Fishermen of Alaska. United Fishermen of Alaska is a statewide commercial fishing trade association representing 37 commercial fishing organizations participating in fisheries throughout the state and the federal fisheries off Alaska's coast. UFA supports Tom Carpenter for appointment to the Alaska Board of Fisheries. He has significant experience with fisheries around the state and has held leadership roles in various committees, councils, and groups. Tom Carpenter possesses a wealth of knowledge and fisheries-related experience earned both on the local as well as the regional levels. He has been an active participant on the South Central Regional Advisory Council to the Federal Subsistence Board and the Copper River Prince William Sound Fish and Game Advisory Committee. And he was awarded the Alaska Department of Fish and Game Excellence in Service Award in 2020 for his ability to connect with diverse user groups and his approachability. He currently serves as the chairman of the board of directors for the Prince William Sound Aquaculture Corporation. Mr. Carpenter is also a longtime business owner, former commercial fisherman, and an avid sportsman. His history of working with a variety of user groups, along with his reputation amongst fisheries professionals around the state, speaks to his qualifications to serve as a member on the Board of Fisheries. In closing, United Fishermen of Alaska is happy to support Tom Carpenter for the Board of Fisheries, and thank you once again for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Tracy. We appreciate that. Is anybody else in the room here to testify for Mr. Carpenter? Yes, sir. Please put yourself on the record and briefly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jerry McCune. I represent Cordova District Fishermen United, which was established in 1935. I had to throw that in there just to make it known. I've known Mr. Carpenter ever since he came to Cordova. I've fished for 62 years, and he's a very dedicated person to all the fisheries, not just the commercial fisheries. He does a lot of sport fishing himself. He actually got me a couple tips on how to catch halibut better than I was doing. So anyway, he's very qualified. He will be fair to all fishermen and all gear types in the state, and he takes it very serious. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, sir. Thanks for being here to testify. Is there anybody else who would like to testify in the room? All right, seeing none, we're going to close public testimony. Public testimony on Mr. Carpenter is now closed. Thank you again, Mr. Carpenter, for being here, and thank you for your willingness to serve. All right, next we're going to move on to appointee number two, Mr. Weitz, for the Board of Fisheries. Mr. Weitz, if you could please put yourself on the record and begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is David Weitz. I'm the President and CEO of Three Bears Alaska. I've hunted and fished around our great state most of my life. I've enjoyed a lot of the great outdoor activities our state has to offer. I've raised my 7 children here in Alaska, and we currently have 11 grandchildren. Under the qualifications, I've led and grown my company for the past 20 years and have had a deep experience with complex issues, along with the balancing the interest of various parties. The reason why I'd like to serve on the board is I believe the ultimate goal is to preserve our fisheries for all stakeholders, including our children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and beyond. What would I bring to the board, I guess, would be problem-solving, balance of stakeholders. I've dealt with many regulatory commissions throughout my career while opening new store locations within our state. By being in retail, I've seen the impact of regulations. So finding solutions to satisfy all parties is sometimes the largest thing that we've had to do, and I look forward to serving on the board. Thank you for your consideration, and I'll take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Weitz. Do we have questions from committee members? All right, I don't see any. Thank you for your willingness to be here. I think what we're going to do is move through the rest of these appointees and get to public testimony on all of them after we move through. So thank you again, Mr. Weitz, for being here. I don't see any questions. Thank you for your willingness to serve. We're going to move on to appointee number three, Mr. Heimbuch. Mr. Heimbuch, if you could please put yourself on the record and tell us why you want to serve.
Mr. Chairman, good afternoon. First, I should ask you if you can hear me.
We can.
Yes. My name is Floyd Michael Heimbuch. I do go by Mike. I'm a longtime resident of Homer and a 70-year resident of the state of Alaska. I'm interested in serving on the Board of Fish because I bring a commercial fishery perspective that stretches back to 1963. As you probably can see from the blurb we submitted for our applications, I have a very extensive background in a lot of different fisheries around the state. And I think that's very important that we understand what the people in these various gear groups commercially go through. We need to know what the people in various aspects of the sport fishery are going through. We have three lenses basically on the board that we view things under. There's economic, biological, and political, of course. Those things are not always easy to solve, but my bent is that we be very aware that when we listen to very heartfelt testimony, that we don't get in a position of revolutionizing fisheries because we have some problems. We have had problems. We've had problems since I was a very young person. They're interesting to solve, but you have to take a little different viewpoint than when you're in front of the board trying to get something to happen. I'm looking forward to the opportunity to serve.
Thank you, Mr. Heimbuch. Do we have questions from committee members? Going once. All right. Well, we appreciate your willingness to serve. Thanks for being here. And we'll move on, sir. No questions.
All right,
Senator Machiko.
Yeah, and this is for Mr. Weitz as well. I would love to ask some questions. We're trying to get through the rest of the appointees for this meeting. And if it ends up going quickly and we get through public testimony, I may have some additional questions. But the few questions with Mr. Carpenter took some time. So I just want these guys to know that we're not any less interested. We're just trying to get through this list, and we might come back if that's okay with you.
Absolutely.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes. Okay. Yes. So, yeah, we certainly don't want to rush it. We want to do as much work as we can and just try and streamline the process as best as we can. We certainly don't want to rush it. So we definitely will come back around. So please stay on the line, Mr. Heimbuch, and thank you for your testimony. Next, we will move on to Al. For the Board of Game, Al, could you please, Al Barrett, please put yourself on the record and tell us why you want to continue to serve.
All right. Good afternoon, Chair Reback and Senate Resource Committee members. For the record, my name is Al Barrett. I live in Fairbanks. I have three adult children who are all born in Fairbanks. I have one grandson who's 7 years old now. They're all raised utilizing Alaska's fish and wild resources. We all participate in all uses of subsistence, personal use, and sport fisheries. We only take what we can use and share. My wife, Linda Bashke, is a project manager for your University of Alaska statewide. She's also a licensed falconer, and she's currently working with a peregrine falcon named Ulu. I served in the Army for approximately 10 years before I was honorably discharged. My last duty station was Fairbanks. My primary occupation is a fur dresser that I've owned since 1992. I also supplement my income from my trapping efforts. I currently also have a Class A guide's license, which I utilize about 10 days a year. But let me just say that I do not have a commercial interest. I do not advertise or book hunts. I only participate in one hunt a year as an employee of a registered guide. My interest on being in the Board of Game is not to favor commercial interest, but to manage our wildlife resources sustainably. I believe I still have a lot to offer. Being on the Board of Game, I have historical knowledge of many issues. I have volunteered 20 years of my time to wildlife management through my local AC, working groups, planning teams, and special work sessions. I have a working knowledge of the federal subsistence process, and I understand subsistence law and its priorities. I have a grandson who's 7 years old. I hope he and all the other grandchildren in Alaska are afforded the same opportunities we have today. And I'll stop there, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Barrett. Do we have questions right out of the gate for Mr. Barrett? All right. Seeing none, appreciate your willingness to continue to serve, sir. Next, we will move on to appointee number five for the Board of Game, Ms. Cusack. Ruth Cusack for the Board of Game. Ruth, if you could please put yourself on the record and tell us why you want to serve. Oh, Ruth, you have to take yourself off of mute. There we go.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Wonderful. First off, I want to thank you for this opportunity. My name is Ruth Cusack. I grew up in rural Iowa. I am the youngest of six. My dad hunted to put food on the table. Being the youngest and a girl, he never took me hunting, no matter how much I begged him. I didn't start hunting till my 20s. It began with rabbits and squirrels and then quickly moved on to whitetail and turkey. I had never imagined ever hunting big game in Alaska. I met my husband, Lewis, in 2006, and on my first trip to Alaska, I was hooked. Lewis took me to Stewart on an all-day halibut charter, and on the drive back to Anchorage, we stopped in Cooper Landing and spotted for black bears until the wee hours of the morning. That fall, on another visit to Alaska, Lewis had drawn the Delta bison permit. It was 20 below, and the ground was covered with 2 feet of snow. It was difficult hunting, but very beautiful. He shot a respectable bull, and when I tasted the meat from the harvest, I was thinking that it couldn't get any better than this. I moved up to Alaska for good in the spring of 2007 and took off running. I absolutely love remote wilderness hunting. We go on several hunts a year. We have a float hunt for moose in Unit 23 every single year since I moved here. It's my favorite hunt. We've hunted caribou, black bear, sheep in the Brooks, Alaska, and Wrangell mountain ranges, mountain goats, and black-tailed deer on Kodiak. There were times I felt like I spent more time sleeping in a tent than in my bed at home. A few years back, I drew the Nunavak Island muskox tag and took a gorgeous bull. Lewis worked a two-week rotation on the North Slope, and while he was gone, I would volunteer for various nonprofit organizations. Alaska Healing Hearts had a black bear camp for veterans suffering from PTSD every year. I helped guide the veterans on black bear hunts. I also volunteer with Becoming an Outdoors Woman Winter's Workshop every year, teaching moose hunting and field dressing. I also have helped with kids' outdoor programs such as Raise Them Outdoors and the Birchwood Youth Day at the Range. In 2012, I started
volunteering for our local SCI chapter and eventually became a part of their board of directors. I strongly believe in their mission and what they stand for. Hunters advocacy, conservation, along with so many other amazing worthwhile programs. I am currently the vice president of the chapter. Between Lewis and the rest of the SCI Alaska board, our chapter and especially our banquets have become very successful. In 2020, I became a licensed assistant guide. We work for Mike Oden. I spend about 3 weeks in the spring and 10 days in the fall hunting bears on the Alaska Peninsula. We also hunt for moose for Mike a couple of weeks a year as well. It's become more fun for me to watch someone else harvest an animal than myself. They get so excited. Our work as guides is not our bread and butter. We do it because it's a great way to get out and do what we love. The reason I want to be on the board of game is that I love Alaska and I love the animals. I want them to be healthy and resilient. All future generations should be able to enjoy what I am enjoying now. As a board member, I will listen to all sides and make common sense decisions based on the data and science presented to me. I believe that emotions should have no part in the management of game. Whatever is best for the resource is all that matters. Being a female and on the board, I can add another perspective, and I hope that I may be able to inspire other women and young folks to get outdoors and go hunting in our beautiful state and to love and respect the land and animals as much as I do. As a conservationist who cares deeply for the future of our resources, it is the highest honor to be appointed to the Alaska Board of Game. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ruth. Do we have any questions? Yes, Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to do my best to set aside my jealousy that Ms. Cusack draws better tags than I do, apparently with some consistency. Ms. Cusack, thanks for your work and all your volunteering, especially with outdoor education, a passion of mine. With regard to the board, I think the board is losing, is not having reappointed its one subsistence sort of representative. And I wonder if you could talk about how you see the board functioning without anyone in a subsistence seat.
You know, we are subsistence hunters, my husband and I. We eat everything that we shoot, of course, besides, you know, brown bears. But everything else, you know, we bring home and put it in our freezer or where we moose hunt at, we actually donate at least 50% of our meat to the village that we hunt out of. So subsistence is very important to us.
Okay, additional
other members.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On a somewhat different tack, you've seen, I think, if you've seen some of the public comments that have come in, concern from some folks that with the current list of appointments, I think 70% of the board would be guides or former guides. And of course, much as we would always like every decision to be answered by a clear scientific response, sometimes there are judgment calls and occasionally questions of allocation and resident and non-resident issues. Can you speak to, I guess, how the board will function and what Alaskans should be able to, what Alaskans' perceptions should be if the board were to end up 70% guides and former guides?
You know, first and foremost, I'm a hunter and I'm a resident of Alaska. Being a guide is not my bread and butter. It should have nothing to do with, you know, me being a part of the board of game. I think, you know, it's my passion is what the reason why I am a guide, because I love what I do and it's a great way to get out and do what I enjoy. I don't think it should have any, you know, anything to do with being on the board of game, because we're just, you know, assistant guides. It's not, you know, our full-time job.
Follow-up, Chair?
Follow-up?
Thank you. I appreciate that, and I appreciate you being willing to just have an open conversation. Do you have a sense, because clearly you are well-educated and involved in these issues, do you have a sense, are there places where we maybe don't have the resident-non-resident mix right today and where we might want to look for adjustments?
You know, I don't know if I'm really informed enough to speak on that. I just know, you know, how I am and how I feel. I don't look at myself as a guide per se. You know, I look at myself as a hunter. You know, I hunt in Alaska. You know, it's moose hunting and you know, goat hunting and blacktail hunting. You know, that's how I put meat in my freezer. You know, I don't know how to respond to the rest of it, honestly.
And I think Ms. Cusack is being pretty modest. I've watched too, as I know Lewis and Ruth, and have watched them in their tireless, Ruth in particular, in her tireless volunteer efforts through nonprofit organizations related to conservation, wildlife conservation and management efforts, and all kinds of things to those ends for well over a decade. So we appreciate that. Maybe you could talk a little bit more about some of the interests that you have for the board. What do you seek to do? What are some things that need to be done on the board of game? What are your interests there?
You know, just making sure that the animals are healthy. I know there's a huge concern about, you know, the sheep population. You know, I'd like to see, you know, more being done about the sheep population. You know, different areas that, you know, there's problems with the moose. You know, I hope that I could help, you know, making some decisions on that as well. I hope to, you know, possibly inspire some people, you know, to get out and enjoy our state.
Thank you, Ms. Cusack. Additional questions? Okay. Thank you very much to all the members. Your willingness to serve and volunteer your time and effort is we thank you for that. We're going to move on to public testimony on all the members except for Mr. Carpenter, who we already heard testimony on. So we'll open public testimony. It's now open for all the members except for Mr. Carpenter. And we're going to start with Mark Richards of Fairbanks. Mark, could you please put yourself on the record and give us your testimony?
Yeah, but first, can you hear me okay, Senator?
Yes, we can, sir.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Rivak and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mark Richards. I'm the Executive Director of Resident Hunters of Alaska, and I'll be representing our group today. I hope you've all had a chance to read the letter that we sent in. It was sent to all three Board of Game appointees as well, and we have discussed our position with all of them. You've already heard Mr. Tooney, so I would just like to speak in general to the two appointments you heard today. And we certainly believe, you know, that all of the individuals appointed or reappointed to the Board of Game are qualified to serve. But we must oppose any more guides on the Board of Game, regardless of class of their guide license, as it clearly does not provide a diversity of interest and points of view that the statute calls for with board appointments, and clearly unbalances the board, real or perceived, in favor of commercial hunting interests. Beyond that, it just, you know, well, darn it, it just looks bad. and furthers the opinion of so many resident hunters that their voices aren't being considered or heard. I want to stress that our opposition has nothing to do with whether or not we like and respect the appointees. We do, and we certainly believe they are all qualified. This puts us in an uncomfortable position to oppose good appointees, but we firmly believe it is wrong on many levels to have the 7-member Board of Game be comprised of 5 licensed hunting guides, regardless of their class of license or how many hunts they conduct. If you confirm the 3 appointments during the confirmation hearings later this session, there will be 5 licensed guides and 1 retired guide on the 7-member board. I look forward to discussing this further with you and about the current appointment process and makeup of the boards of fisheries and game and how the system could be improved, which I mentioned in our letter. Again, we don't like to be in this position, but we must oppose such an unbalanced makeup of the Board of Game. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Richards. We're going to take a real quick brief at ease. We're back on the record. Charles Derrick. Charles, please put yourself on the record and give us 2 minutes or less.
Yes, thank you, Chairman. My name is Chuck Derrick, Charles Derrick. I'm speaking, comments are my personal comments. I have had the pleasure to be on the Fairbanks Advisory, Fish and Game Advisory Committee when Al Brett was a member. He is not a member right now. Because he was on the Board of Fish. But you won't find anybody more knowledgeable in regulations, a codified book. He's probably more knowledgeable than any of your wildlife troopers are. Any question, that man can just go thumb through that book and find what you need right away. He's very knowledgeable on all the game management units of Alaska. He's done nothing but impress me the whole time I've worked with him. Thank you.
Thank you, Chuck. Next, we're going to move on to Virgil. Virgil, from up there in the Fairbanks LIO, please put yourself on the record in 2 minutes or less.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to support for the Board of Fisheries, David Weiss, and for the Board of Game, both Al Barrett and Beatrice Cusack. I've been on the Fairbanks Advisory Committee, since I got off the Board of Fish, and I believe that's 18 years. I was chairman for 8 years. Al Barrett was on the Fairbanks Fish and Game Advisory Committee with me we were on there together a minimum of 14 years, maybe 15 years. But Al is extremely knowledgeable of the board process. He's a very fair person, and he's a very scientific person. And his knowledge when it comes to sustained yield, how the process works, and the predator-prey relationship, along with the habitat relationships between the habitat and the animals that we all want to hunt, he has more knowledge in those fields than 99.9% of the public. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thanks, Virgil. Next, we'll move on to Paul. Paul from Cook Inlet. Please put yourself on the record. Give us 2 minutes or less.
Thank you, Senator Reebok, members of the Resource Committee. Again, this is Paul Ishter II. I reside in Pisilov. Mr. Heimbach states, board selection process should gravitate more towards people who have a background with both a broad array of participation and a decent understanding. I would not agree more with this, and especially if it was codified as a requirement. Clearly, his history speaks in volumes. His practical applications and qualifications, he should be confirmed. Mr. Weiss does not appear to list many fisheries-related experiences. What has happened in practice is the subsequent administrations and legislatures have, in fact, made several appointments in consideration of political affiliations, and by appointing several board members from the South Central region,
chest freezer.
Providing a diversity of interests is extremely difficult. Concentrations of Alaskans live within South Central. Their views are important. But the fisheries resources of the state are dispersed regionally and pose very different biological and social issues. Alaskan constitutional framers deliberated over the Board of Fisheries and Game up to the final acceptance of the final document. Some considerations were given to Citizens Board that would change membership to reflect different geographical interests and types of fish and fisheries. The avoidance of political affiliations and geographical locations was to allow a more diverse volunteer board. It is time that the legislature review and amend current qualifications and guidelines, the purpose being to update the process to avoid political considerations and enhance the process through appointing board members who have strong scientific, practical application, historical knowledge, and reasonable perspective in the field of action. Completing this update will greatly improve the expertise on the board and reduce the political conflicts legislators and administrations are currently forced to evaluate within. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thanks, Paul. Next.
Wait a second. Mr. Shardora, which Board of Fish members do you support and which do you not support? This is public testimony for three Board of Fish appointees, if that's what you're referring to.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair, through the Chair. It was a little confusing. I came here to speak on each individual and then we were to combine them, so I tried to do the best I can. Clearly, I support Mr. Heimbach. I also support Mr. Carpenter. Mr. Weiss, I do not have a recommendation for because of his lack of experience. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul.
Thanks, Paul. Again, next we'll go to Shannon. Shannon from Soldotna, please. Name, affiliation in 2 minutes or less.
Good evening. My name is Shannon Martin, and I'm the Executive Director of the Kenai River Sport Fishing Association. The Kenai River Sport Fishing Association, KRSA, is a nonprofit 501c3 dedicated to ensuring the sustainability of the greatest sport fishing river in the world, the Kenai. KRSA's area of responsibility encompasses the Kenai River watershed, Greater Cook Inlet Basin, and Alaska. KRSA is in support of the governor's nomination, David Weiss, to the Board of Fisheries. Mr. Weiss is a proven leader through his many years of managing and growing a successful Alaskan grocery store chain. He's a well-respected businessman, and we believe he will listen to all sides and make fair and impartial decisions for all user groups. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you, Shannon. All right, do we have anyone else online that we know? Okay. I'm just want to make sure I double check here. All right, is there anybody in the room who would like to testify on any of these appointees? Welcome back, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jerry McKeon. I represent that organization, CDFU, that was established in 1935. I want to keep saying that so you guys get that. Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. I support Mike Heimbach for the Board of Fish. I've known him probably for 40 years. He has a pretty good experience fishing around the whole state, but he also has the same as Mr. Carpenter. He does know about the personal use fisheries assistance and the other fisheries. And I think he will probably do a good job and be very fair to all the users on the Board of Fish. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, sir. Anyone else to testify in the room? Welcome back.
Tracy Welch for United Fishermen of Alaska again. Thank you. UFA supports Mike Heimbach for appointment to the Alaska Board of Fisheries. He has significant experience with fisheries around the state and has held leadership roles in various committees, councils, and groups. Mr. Heimbach is a longtime commercial fisherman here in the state of Alaska who has participated in fisheries across the state dating back to the 60s. Throughout his fishing career, he has fished Prince William Sound, Cook Inlet, Bristol Bay, the Alaska Peninsula, and Adak. In addition to fishing experience, Mr. Heimbach has been active in fishing issues across the state. He's previously worked in the legislature as a fisheries aide to the Speaker of the House, been active in fisheries associations, served on the Bering Sea Advisory Board, and has been nominated twice for a seat on the North Pacific Fishery Management Council. Mr. Heimbach has also been active in his hometown of Homer, having served on the City Council, Port and Harbor Advisory Commissions, and the Library Board. His fisheries experience, paired with his experience on a variety of boards and commissions, and his familiarity with fishing issues around the state, will serve him well on the Board of Fisheries. In closing, UFA is happy to support Mike Heimbach for Board of Fisheries. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Tracy. Is there anybody else in the room who would like to testify? All right. Seeing none, we're going to close public testimony. Public testimony on the appointees is now closed. All right. Do we have specific questions from committee members?
I have a question for Mr. Heimbach. The best way to move through this process is if there's anything that you think we should know about in your past. I don't need to make that sound ominous. I've at least heard that you had a fisheries conviction, and it'd be nice to know what that is. And if you can kind of tell us the story, it often just clears the air. No one's perfect, as all of us at this desk know, other than perhaps Senator Stevens. I haven't checked with Rita, but can you fill us in on what that occurrence was about?
Senator Machiki, through the chair. Yeah, I absolutely can. One of those was in 1987. The other one, I think, was 1989. The one in 1987 was at a time when we were transitioning in Cook Inlet from a three-mile radar line into a straight line that was navigable with a GPS or a plotter. And as you well know from your own personal experience there, when the land goes in and out, it's kind of hard to maintain where you are. And so some of the problems that we had for a couple of years there resulted in Fish and Game and Protection working together to establish a line that was more in keeping with what the tide did up and down Cook Inlet on the east side. It was a long time ago. It's a very competitive fishery. Another one happened for me out in Bristol Bay when, as some of the people may be familiar with, you have to drop what's called a blue card before you go fishing at the start of the season. I fished in a cannery that generally took those cards over by airplane to ADF&G over in King Salmon, and some of us who did not know that the planes couldn't fly for 2.5 days ended up fishing illegally, for that matter, and we found out a year and a half later when they sorted through the archives of blue cards that we had done something bad. And that's about as what I can say about those violations.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Mr. Heimbach. I just wanted to get it. If folks are talking about it, then if there's any opposition to you, they will be talking about it as well, especially those that – and I've never had a fisheries violation – but when things have happened, like a hydraulic pump crashing when I'm 2 miles from the line, I'll just say I've also gotten lucky from time to time. So we do our best to always follow the rules, and sometimes things happen. But I appreciate you being straight with that. I think it's important, and it was a long time ago. I understand both cases of what you're talking about, so I don't know if anyone had any follow-up questions, but I just wanted to clear the air in your, not really defense, but give you, often in this business, folks that are appointed don't have an opportunity to speak up for themselves. And often those stories can get worse over a few days when people just, it's like those campground things where you whisper into someone's ear and it gets more interesting with each passing quote. So I appreciate you coming out with it, and I think it's helpful for us to consider.
Thank you, Senator. Even amongst my friends, that story has grown over time as they rib me about it.
All right, other questions, comments? No. All right, brief at ease. On the record, Mr. Vice Chair, can I get a motion?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. I move that the following appointees for the Board of Fisheries, Thomas Carpenter, David Wise, Floyd Mike Heimbach, and Board of Game, Alan Al Barrett, and Beatrice Ruth Cusack, be forwarded to a joint session of the legislature for consideration.
Thank you. Are there any objections? Okay, seeing no objections, the motion passes, and for the record, in accordance with Alaska Statute 3905080, a signature on this report does not reflect any intent by any of the members to vote for or against the confirmation of individuals during any further sessions. We will now wrap up here. Again, I thank everybody for staying so late. Thank you to the committee members for your attention. The staff, as always, please stick around to sign the paperwork for these appointees. Thank you to the presenters and those willing to serve to be here to testify. Our next regularly scheduled meeting will be this coming Wednesday, April 13th, 2022. Where we will bring up SB 177, where we left off today. SB 180, passenger vessel environmental compliance, HB 54, invasive species management, and SB 219, transfer public use cabins permit. This meeting is now adjourned at 5:29 p.m.